Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
Hello, welcome to Hump Day Hangout, February 16th, and appreciate everybody tuning in. So today we're going to talk about RIT, and I know there's a lot of there's always a lot of chatter about RIT. There's always there's a lot of Hump Day offerings about it, and of course it's a sought after topic anywhere you go for any of the conferences, including our own FDIC. But today we're joined by Lieutenant Basil Abraham. Did I say that right? Abraham.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So he's from hails from the Orlando Fire Department. And so we're going to get into a program that he offers and talk RIT. And the title of the show was, Are You Ready to Intervene? Because that's kind of what we want to focus on is how you're doing it and what your mindset is and put your focus on it and that sort of thing. But before we dive into our topic this week, first of all, welcome to everybody on the show. Chief Lasky is out. He's preaching the good word somewhere. I don't know where he is this week, but, I'm sure he has a gaggle of people waiting for his arrival to dazzle them over the next couple of days. But, but Chief Salka, thanks to Chief Thompson here and Chief Halton's on the show. And so Chief Halton, let's talk about FDIC real quick. Give us some updates and everyone, if you haven't heard of FDIC, it's April 25th through the 30th in the wonderful Indianapolis metropolitan area. So Chief Salka or Chief Halton. Give us an FDIC update.
Well, registration is open, and I think the early bird special still applies. We're about, 10 or 12 weeks away. It's going to be an incredible show. A couple of classes are close to selling out. We have a cadaver lab this year that's actually sold out already. So if you're going to do the cadaver lab, you're out. If you like seeing dead people, you'll just have to hang out with Salka more. So just teasing you, Johnny. So anyway, so classes are selling out. RIT Under Fire has limited space left in it. Stretching for Success is pretty much getting filled up. Couple of really great classes. Aaron Fields is back with us with Nozzle Forward again this year. So the hands-on training is going incredibly well. Got a couple of really cool new classes that are going to sell out. We've got a water rescue class, which is fascinating because so many of us do, we got Basil on talking about water. He's in Orlando. Do that piece of math, the great state of Florida. So they got water everywhere, but whether it's like Louisville or whether it's Grapevine or whether it's, upstate New York and one of the beautiful Finger Lakes or along the Long Island coast or wherever you are, we all have water rescue stuff. So we've got this really cool guy named Mike Hudson, who, if you had a chance to see Shark Week this year, he was on Shark Week with the Jackass crew. He's the medic that jumped into the water when the Jackass guy got literally bitten by a shark. This guy jumped in and saved him. So he's doing this incredible water rescue class. It's not a dive class. It's a water rescue class, which when you think about it, we all our jobs have some level of importance there in that field. So that's pretty cool. We got some really great new stuff going on for our EMS side of the house, for our medics. We got hands-on classes. We got the active shooter now has a medic component for packaging people, for those active shooter things that we all go to. So that's fantastic. That's really going to fill up quickly. So we've got some really great opportunities on the hands-on. The workshops are crushing it. You've got Chief Salka, Chief Lasky, Chief Thompson are all doing, workshops. So you want to, some of those guys, sign up now because they're going to sell out. They're just going to sell out. Now that the COVID thing seems to have run its course, we saw a spike last week in registrations that was just phenomenal because, I guess the checkered flag has been, it's kind of game on, right? So please sign up. We are going to have an incredible opening ceremonies. We've got Doug Mitchell from the FDNY. We've got Dan Shaw from Fairfax. We've got Dave Page. We've got Frank Viscuso. I mean, four of the best speakers in the fire service, all guys with incredible messages, really different kind of cats. We've got an incredible, Joe Netter is going to get the Training Achievement Award, and our Lifetime Achievement Award is going to go to a guy who we all know and love and long overdue and well-deserved, Chief John Salka is going to be the Lifetime Achievement Award winner. So you want to be there for that. I mean, every single one of us has known John for our whole careers. We love him. Can't wait to recognize John on the big stage. So you absolutely want to get there and for the main program early, because that does, you know, we always tell folks, but John, and we've all been there. We can tell you, we have to lock those doors because you have, you know, guys and gals lining the walls, and there's a lot of fire marshals in the crowd. So we got to be careful. And, you end up in the hallway, and you don't want to end up in the hallway this year, because it's just going to be freaking phenomenal. And then the Fool's Bash is on, the Fun Run is on, the Stair Climb is on, the Union Party is on. Chief Salk and Chief Lasky will be holding court. As always, you know, it's going to be just an amazing time. It's, you know, we really need to get back to this, right? And I don't mean, no disrespect to the hangouts, but we need to get back to the in-person nuanced stuff, to where you can, you know, punch each other in the shoulder and laugh. And you know what I mean? We just got to get back to it. So please sign up now. I can't help you get a downtown hotel room if you call me up on April the 5th. You know what I mean? I can't help you get a downtown hotel room, period. But, you know, if something sells out, it sells out. I can't do anything for you. So, the one cool thing we're going to have, if there are any medics out there, good street medics, we're having a medic competition called the GEMS Games. Three-person teams, just like it would be on the street. You know, it could be two paramedics and an EMT or whatever. We recommend two paramedics and EMT, or three paramedics. And we're going to film it live. We're going to film it live before a big crowd. They've been doing it for about 10 years. It's called the GEMS Games. And it's a real-life scenario. It's going to look – it looks like a real scene. They got cameras. They got people judging it. And we have opening for 15 teams to compete. They got some prelim. But the three finalists are going to do it on Friday morning in the big room, like where we hold the main program. So we'll have like, you know, 4,000 people watching them. So it's going to be just incredible. And those medics get to have bragging rights as they're like the best medics in the country for 2022. So if you're a medic out there and you want to compete, go to the gemsgames.com, register. It's free. We ask you for $100 just to hold your spot, but we give you the $100 back. So sign your team up there. And come and compete. So many cool things going on. I've probably forgotten a million really cool things, but the Cancer Support Network is doing the Fun Run this year. So Thursday night, if you want to run and remember somebody, you have a chance with the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, you know, to run in somebody's memory, or for somebody who's fighting cancer, you know, run in their honor, run to help them, you know, fight the good fight. So thank you for letting me throw the pitch out there. I love the show. Sorry to take up so much time, but it's such a great show. And we've got just, it's the greatest lineup I've ever seen. And I know I say that every year, but every year it just seems to be better. And this year it promises to be no exception. So thank you. And I hope to see you all there.
Well, and I'll say this, I think the EMS offerings and what you're describing on this competition or whatever, and I think that's appropriate. I'm glad to see that. You know, I've spent my entire life in a dual service department that is a large part of what we do and will always be a large part of what we do. And so it's nice to see a little bit wider swath of activity in FDIC. And I like to see that especially. Scott, we talked about just to jump into the topic this week and talking about RIT. And so we've had a couple of our sessions where we, you know, attempt to solve the world's problems, or at least the problems within the fire service. But, you know, we've talked about RIT and how we staff it. And I don't think, you know, and so in the interest of full disclosure, Louisville, we have 8 stations. We have pre-arrival assignments. Our third in engine takes RIT unless there's an audible called kind of thing. You know, and so we, the responsibility of RIT is spread around, obviously, because like I said, it's kind of dependent on your order of arrival. And so And I think our model, the way we do it, is certainly very, very common in this area. But there's a few things that have always stuck out with me and have concerned me about RIT and kind of where our focus and attention is on it, is that sometimes I think it tends to be a box we check as an incident commander, or certainly going through our benchmarks. We have to make sure that we stand that up. And I think, and I'm not saying that anyone doesn't focus enough energy on it because they don't believe in it, or they don't believe that it's a worthy or value. But fortunately for us, it's something we don't deploy often. And so, you know, I tell people sometimes, I had a explosives bomb dog with ATF for like 7 years, and it was one of the most miserable. It was an awesome experience, but it was miserable from the standpoint of, I never found anything. I mean, she found a gun one day, but I never found any explosives. But yet you go out every day, and it's a food reward dog. So you train every day. You have to go through very a lot, and you have to keep the dog focused and energized. And so, I mean, you can't just do routine stuff. You got to go through all these, very elaborate kind of scenarios to make things lifelike for the dog and to keep their motivation going and all that. But at the end of the day, we never found anything. So sometimes I kind of liken that to RIT in that, you know, well, I RIT again, because you stand, you know, what you typically hear, we stand in the yard and we watch everybody else do stuff. And so what always concerns me, and like the way we do it, so our engines are 99% of the time staffed with three people. And so that's a three person RIT crew. And I've often sat in that, in the command role, looking over at that group, thinking to myself, this is not enough. And the other thing that I speak for myself personally, sitting in that role as an incident commander, is I don't grow that group to match the size of what we're doing. And that's a huge failure on my part. This leads into the conversation Scott and I had one day, which was, you know, we should really sit down and think about beefing up our RIT on a routine and regular basis and scale it so that when we're on a large multi-alarm, multi-family, four-story, or even a large big box warehouse, something like that, that we are fully capable of actually, we're propping that group up for success, and they have every opportunity to succeed at what we're fixing to ask them to do. So Scott, you know, I kind of throw that to you and to get your thoughts, and then we'll kind of, you know, get into our guest here and what he talks about and his particular program. But Scott, you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, Terry, you know, we think a lot alike, and I'm excited today. I've been following Basil here for a while, and some of my guys went to one of his classes and said it was like a punch in the gut and realized some things. But, you know, it really goes back, John, when I was teaching with you and Rick, when you were doing Get Out Alive and Saving Our Own, and we were starting to, you know, the early day RIT stuff, right, when we were figuring kind of stuff out. And back then, it seemed like it was really focused on common sense. You know, we're going to get in there, we're going to find them, we're going to get them out. We're not going to do all this rigging and all this things that we're kind of doing now. And so just the simplicity of it. But I was involved in a fire, and Terry, you might have been there many years ago. We had a car dealership on fire, and it was during business hours, right? So you always say, how do you tell if you have occupants, cars in the parking lot, right? Well, that doesn't work at a car dealership. So we had a massive, very, very serious fire. Rick was there. And that was the first time that it really occurred to me. But I think before it was said and done, I had three engines, a truck, two medics, and a chief officer in rapid intervention. That was my rapid intervention group. I felt a strong urge to build that to meet that incident, because we had so many problems going on. But and then what kind of put a twist in things was after Brett Tarver was killed at Southwest Supermarket, when I think it was John Brunenstein came out with the RIT isn't always rapid, and we started talking about the use of on deck crews versus assigning a rapid intervention crew. And then you look at John.
It was actually a Steve Kreiss.
Oh, Steve Kreiss. Okay, I'm sorry, Steve Kreiss. But it was Brett Tarver. It was after Brett Tarver at Southwest Supermarket when that whole discussion kind of started. So we all kind of rethinking how we do that. You know, the majority of the stuff that we go to is lightweight construction. It's going to be, you know, a floor to maybe five or six floors. but a lot of things can go wrong. And so, you know, I really want to hear, Lieutenant, from you, a couple things that really made sense is number one, I love your proactive stance. And I think we all believe that rapid intervention needs to be proactive. The other part was the remove the formality. You know, let's draw the line of, let's just get down and dirty. Every operation I've been in that has involved a firefighter rescue has just been down and dirty. Grab them and get them out. And we don't have a lot of time to do all the things that we hear. And then making it personal. We make it personal, and that has a lot of benefits. So those are really some of the things that I would love to hear, kind of how you got to where you are, what went into developing One Bad Day, and then some of your thoughts about some of those things.
All right, Chief. So the whole program started, and my curiosity on risk started following the Florida Smoke Diver program that I attended in 2015. It really humbled me, and I started diving into the whole RIT component and the survival air management, the command, and really taking my job a lot more seriously than I've had in the past. So we developed this program, the One Bad Day, where we do a presentation, lecture, and a hot course. And essentially, we try to keep it basic, simple, and removing any training scars. I haven't attended a class prior to the Smoke Diver program that really mimic the realism of the fire ground, using a live victim, you know, real heat, real time-based events, allowing you to use everything that you have on a regular basis, not blacking you out all the time, letting you use your tick, and so on and so forth. So essentially, the program was born from the class. I tell a story. In 2008, I worked for a different agency, and I was on an engine, a three-person engine-based search, and I had my first grab, first victim removal. I had 4 years on the job back then, and I touched that lady no less than 5 or 6 times, and never once registered that it was a person in my head. We kept searching that room, because they had reports of the ladies in there. Well, I've searched that room 3 or 4 times. In my head, I never found the lady. But afterwards, reflecting on it, the person was in that room, and I did a lot of thinking, well, why? Why did I not recognize that that was a person? Well, because all we've done is train with mannequins. Mannequins, mannequins, mannequins. My brain was conditioned at feeling a hard, rigid, plasticky thing, not a pliable human flesh. I have never done that before. So since that day and after the program, the Smoke Diver program, everything that we do on my company and in our class, we try to use real life equipment, real life timing, and limit the training scars. And we train to completion every single time. By training to completion, I mean, we're not just bringing the victim out and dropping him at the front door. We're derobing the victim all the way to putting him on a gurney, administering EMS care and all that. It doesn't stop once we remove the mannequin from the building and high-five each other. So the program it only uses live victims, and it's geared towards RIT operations, a little bit of survival. We also have a command portion on it, commanding maydays, because honestly, I think we need to do a lot more of that in the fire service. We don't do a good job at least in our side of the country, we don't do a good job at preparing our officers for that type of situation. And you got to put it in practice. You have, not just in theory, a lot of practices and strategies are awesome on paper. But the minute you convert it into practical application, you find that it's not as time efficient, or it requires more resources, or so on and so forth. So that's a little bit in a nutshell about the program. And my vision of the reason why I put it down on paper and PowerPoint and started trying to teach is because I want to change the mindset of RIT being viewed as a check the box assignment and a punishment job on the fire ground. That's how I used to think about it. I used to think RIT was boring. I didn't want to be assigned RIT. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Chief McGrath the other day, and I said the first question in my presentation I usually ask the students, the attendees, who wants to force doors and throw ladders and stretch lines and do searches and lower people off rope and blah, blah, blah. Everybody raises their hand. The next question following that I says, who wants to be RIT? And crickets, nothing. Nobody raises their hand. But if you really think about it, the RIT company force doors, they throw ladders, they do searches, there should be, if possible, suppression component with the RIT company. I mean, if you do RIT aggressively and proactively, you're doing all those things. Now, I understand that we all have different staffing level and response times and all of that. I get it. But I want to change that mindset that RIT is a boring job, check the box on the fire ground. And if you look at the data, I'm a data-driven individual. I believe we all have our own opinions. At the end of the day, our tactics should be driven off of data, experience, and training. So that way, there is no opinions out there. You put it to the clock and you look at the data. So looking at the data from Don Abbott's research project, over 86% of the time, the RIT company does not affect the rescue, only 6% of the time. And those are numbers from 2020. I don't believe the 2021 numbers are out yet until March. But so self-rescue has the highest rate, 35% approximately. Then you move on to the victim's crew, high 20s, 27%. Then another interior crew, and then the RIT. Now, if you look at those numbers objectively without really digging into the study, to me, it tells me two things. One, everybody on the fire ground needs to have a level of survival and RIT operations, from the most junior firefighter all the way up to the chief officer. And the closer and the faster you are at making victim contact, the higher survival rate that person is going to have.
Let me interrupt you just for a minute. I may get in trouble for saying this, but all the data and that you're quoting really goes against the whole two in, two out concept.
Yes.
That we all have as a national standard, right? But that's your least chance of getting rescued is by the two in the front yard that are supposed to be standing by to do that. Am I correct in that?
That I feel the same way about you, same way you do. So, but it's backed by data, by numbers, by statistics. So we need to have that mindset, in my opinion, that if you're establishing a RIT company, they need to be proactive. They need to be mobile. They need to be light, fast, surveying the building, softening up the structure. By that, I mean, you know, creating additional egresses, throwing ladders, removing bars, staging strategically around the building in the area of concern, and be ready and prime for activation. You don't have to be deployed as a RIT company to do RIT work. And guys, this is just my opinion. I'm still very new. I'm a student of the game. I'm open to any ideas, criticism, discussions. But at the end of the day, I'm going to take it and I'm going to put it to the clock, because that is what we're fighting in the fire service. Two enemies in the fire service. Time is the number one. Fear is the other. But that's a whole other discussion. Yes, sir.
I want to say I love everything I'm hearing, and there's a couple of quick points. There's a third thing that's an enemy of the fire service, and that is the dreaded fork. You can't outrun time. You can't outrun the fork. So that being said, cardiac is one of our biggest issues, but cardiac is a survival event if you get to good care fast. RIT teams do that. In Oakland, California today, three of our brother firefighters and sister firefighters were transported. Well, how do you think they got transported? The rapid intervention team got them transported. At our recent fatalities in St. Louis and in Baltimore, the people who did RIT are responsible for the survivors of those events, because there were survivors of those events as well as fatalities. And so, and to your point, when Christ wrote a rapid intervention isn't rapid, we all of us went out and subsequently did those drills. And we learned that it takes a long time to get people inside a building, get them out. But we that doesn't mean that we don't need them. What it means is that we need to up the game, right? What it means is that they've got to be in a more heightened state of responsiveness, and they have to have a greater awareness of the conditions that the people are encountering and how to access them in those conditions, right? And so it's to Scott's point about two in, two out, I think really in a lot of ways, and again, please, if you're on Facebook, you know, we're throwing spaghetti at the wall here. We're speaking off the top of our minds. You know, I'm not against two in, two out, but I think it's done two terrible things. It's made liars out of just about every firefighter in America, because the crews, we get there, and, well, you know, we saw it's three guys in a pink Cadillac with Utah plates told us there were people at the window when we pulled up. So that's why all our crews were inside. And the second thing is that, you know, two guys or two gals outside are really not sufficient. And to Basil's point earlier, I wish, and this is going to not to sound mean, or, you know, if I donated my body to science, one of the things I'd be totally okay with is use my cadaver for real RIT training, because an actual dead person is a lot tougher to move than any mannequin I've ever screwed around with, because, you know, they'll go everywhere, and the weight just seems to be far more than any mannequin I've ever touched. So I agree with Basil. Creating greater realism in training is critical to capture, right? Now, we got to be careful about that, because we never want people to fail, you know, repeatedly in training. Coming up short is okay, but failing outright is not, right? We want to build models of success. And so I love what you're doing, and I'd love to come see you do it. And I would think it'd be a good class to have at a place called FDIC. So get off your fat, happy ass and put that proposal in tomorrow so we can accept it for 2023. And I won't even make you shave. I'm just kidding. I told him earlier, before we started, I said, he reminds me of a French movie star. I'm trying to think who that guy was, but you look just like that famous French movie star guy. Anyway, this is really important stuff. And Basil's right. The problem with any skill, any tool, that you better not try to develop it when you need it, because it's too damn late. Anything that you're going to need as a skill on the fire ground, you better be freaking proficient at it before you have to deploy it. And that includes RIT. And if you think RIT is not an important job, go visit with my friends in St. Louis. Go visit with my friends in Boston. Why don't you give a call to the guys and gals up in Oakland this afternoon? And then give me a face when you get assigned RIT next time, because maybe you'll be the guy who's up. And also, one of the things we learned in that rapid intervention isn't rapid training was that the crews, one of our early theories was everybody just needs to keep fighting the fire. I get that, right? Like, you can't just abandon all the other firefighting, but certain crews can be redeployed, right? And so we need to start looking at that as well. Like, if you're a division supervisor and you've got four or five engines under your truck or two, and you hear a RIT go out, if you can cut off some available resources closer to the to supplement the RIT op, that's great stuff, right? So think about your available resources inside the firefight that might be redeployable, but not all of them. Don't give up the attack lines need to keep flowing. The truck companies need to keep doing their jobs. So, and that's where group supervisors, division supervisors, you know, if you've got the A division, or if you've got the D division, or if you're the interior attack, you know, officer in charge, you can't let that go to crap. You can redeploy a certain amount of resources, which will help keep the other people focused on doing what they need to do to get that fire out, so it can help us to get the people who are in trouble out. So, man, I'm thrilled. I want to hear more about it. I need an article and I need a proposal for next year's show. So,
Chief Salka, I know that you and Chief Lasky have done a lot of education in the area of Mayday and RIT training and whatever, but something that was brought up a minute ago. And so, to me, there's kind of a two-pronged thing here, because you allude to the Project Mayday, where we say that most of this is mitigated through self-rescue, or what immediate resources are right there next to you. But there's an element of training that goes along with that. And there's an element of being able to, we run a rescue dive operation here. And that's something that those divers work on constantly, because we have a 90% diver here. He's your RIT team to go down and assist you. But you have to be very competent and capable of starting to solve your problem. And that's where you got to start.
One quick editorial point, Chief McGrath. Chief John Salka is the originator of Saving Our Own. He's the genesis of Saving Our Own. He's the creator of Saving Our Own. He brought in a ton of collaborators, but that's the guy who started Saving Our Own.
So, I'd love to hear, based on what you've heard so far, but kind of what your overall thoughts are on this.
I mean, obviously there's so much to RIT and Mayday. I mean, it's two different words, but it's all the same process, right? And it's as Basil was already talking about, so many of his points are points that Rick and I make. We have a couple of different programs that we do, 3 degrees of Mayday and et cetera, et cetera. One of my I can't call it a pet peeve, because I'm 64 years old and everything seems to be a pet peeve to me now, but one of the things about RIT and Mayday operations that I think is important, there's actually a couple of things like Lunar. Lunar is one of my, it's hard for me to talk about Lunar without really using foul, disgusting language, because I think Lunar is one of the most insidious, ridiculous things that's ever been invented. Whoever invented it, I am sure had the best of intentions, but had to be doing LSD or something, because it doesn't fit into anything. It doesn't fit into anything that we do. The order that the word is formed up is not proper. If you actually use that term, you never actually say what's wrong, why you gave the Mayday. Somebody has to get back to you with a second question and ask you about that. So that's one thing. And people recite it at our classes, and it's quite scary. And then, secondly, is the change in radios. I don't know whose idea it was to change channels during a RIT operation. That is probably the most detrimental thing you could ever do, especially, I mean, forget my opinion. My opinion doesn't even matter. But if you just look at the statistics, as you said, facts, right? If you just look at the number of people that usually encounter and save a firefighter that's given a Mayday, it's usually somebody who, if you change channels, would have been on a different channel. And might not even, it's like you sent them across the street. So those are two of my, I have to tell you my third one. I don't fight the system, but it really bothers me being incident commander. And I was lieutenant and captain of battalion chief, just like everybody else. We all went up through the ranks. We've done all the jobs. And I was always, it really bothers me that RIT is the only thing that somebody is mandating me to do first. Nobody says, oh, you have to stretch your line first and then you can do RIT. Nobody else says you have to get a search team in there first, no matter what, search team first, but then you got to set up a RIT next. No, RIT is the only thing that's mandated to all of us across the whole country. Oh, you're mandated. It's the law. You'll go to jail. I think it's nonsense. I really do think it's nonsense that anybody can mandate an incident commander at the scene of a fire to do any one tactic first ahead of another one. If I'm at the scene of a fire, there might be something else I have to do first. And frankly, I did it my whole career, and I almost just said, luckily nothing ever happened, because suddenly they're after you. Suddenly you're breaking some rule and they're going to whip out some handcuffs on you because you didn't set up the two in, two out first. You sent two guys in for the nine women that were hanging out of the third floor with their hair on fire. You know what I'm saying? So without getting too elaborate about it, this, we need so much work on RIT and Mayday. We need so much work on it. But like Basil is already doing, and some other folks are already doing, right? I think we're starting to do things better by studying it and coming up with with numbers and facts and figures and valid tactics and realizing really what's happening there, rather than just pretending that people are saying what they're saying and, you know, the RIT team is saving them, which just, and I have all the respect for RIT, and we continue to train and teach RIT. I think it's really important, but the impact that they have on actual rescues is, we all know, relatively minor, even if they're engaged the whole fire. You know, we tell guys, you got a lot to do as a RIT team. You shouldn't be standing there watching. You should be very busy, you know, even if you never get deployed. But the fact is, if somebody gives a mayday, you're probably not going to meet them. You're probably not going to meet those RIT guys. You're probably going to meet some other people, you know?
But it's certainly only because I don't want to leave the impression that, I mean, everyone here knows the value, the importance of it and what we're going to do. But I think your basal, point earlier is that there's a large degree or amount of success that's going to occur right then with an individual who's in trouble, with the individual's work group who's in trouble, and that's concerned. But in the meantime, we need some people that are ready to go, that if all those things don't work, then we, you know, it's your plan B. And it needs to be, and I guess when you say, well, it's a plan B, so we don't focus as much on a plan B, or we'll get to that, but let's focus on this. And so, and that's where, in our conversation the other day, when he talked about and you can explain that, Basil, in Orlando, you guys are doing this with a dedicated 5-person, that's your rescue. So explain that and how you guys are putting, I guess, the right number of resources or that key resource in on your fires.
Okay, just right before getting to that, let me expand really quick on the RIT approach there. Everything that you guys are talking about, I 100% agree with, and really it makes me super happy that, well, I'm thinking like all you guys up there. So, but RIT, I view RIT as a two-part approach, not plan A and then plan B. Simultaneously, the RIT company, official RIT company on the outside, is softening up the building, being aggressive, mobile, X, Y, and Z. And then if we get activated, like Chief Sokka says, the incident commander should use the resources on the inside to try to get as much information, maybe get a visual on the person, and try to make the rescue while activating the outside company. So I don't view it as a plan A and plan B, almost like a simultaneous approach of RIT. Obviously, that's situational dependent on, you know, if the interior crews are not able to make victim contact or the fire is progressing or whatnot, but it's a dual approach. Just like when we do primary search, we have a dual approach. We have our interior search and our VES company simultaneously attacking the structure from the inside and outside to cover more searchable space in a shorter amount of time. So as far as how we operate in Orlando, we have a heavy rescue company, which is staffed with 5 personnel, and their assignment on every fire is RIT. So they know that already. I was assigned to it for 2.5 years as a firefighter. And although I've never personally made a RIT rescue, I can guarantee you that I can't even count how many maydays we prevented because of the aggressiveness and the proactiveness of our companies. Just creating extra egresses, having ladders in spot. If somebody is VESing our RIT company, I would climb up the ladder with my tick, just make sure everything was good with the guys and all. The key to that is to not overcommit. You have to be disciplined and be able to not freelance, just do your job, don't overcommit. So we're lucky, we have a lot of manpower. Our heavy rescue is RIT on every fire. We don't deploy a tarp with every single tool laid out nice, perfectly. No, we're mobile. We gauge our cache of equipment based on the building construction, the type of structure, and we stage it according to where the emergency is. We don't even have to talk. Everything is pre-planned. The name of the game is pre-planning. Training, 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 and pre-planning it is going to make you win on the fire ground.
Question.
So we, you get, go ahead, sir.
So you answered it partially already, training. So obviously your heavy rescue has extensive or considerable RIT training, because we all know RIT tactics are nothing like anything else we do. You could be a firefighter in a busy truck for 20 years and you don't know a single RIT tactic. They're all very special, right? Yes, so what if the rescue is not there? What if the rescue is unavailable? Are any other companies trained to do RIT work?
We do a very poor job at that. We ourselves, and I love my fire department. I'm not talking bad. I'm a proud member of the Orlando Fire Department, but we could definitely do a way better job at it. So if the heavy rescue is on a different fire, we have one of our other tower companies will assume the role of RIT. So they also have RIT equipment and do RIT training, but I believe not to the standard that the heavy rescue operates. And it really, like you said, I'm sure this is where you're going with that, Chief Salka, is not just the towers or the heavy needs to be proficient in RIT operations, really any unit, our engines, our ambulances, everybody needs to have a level of RIT operations training. But unfortunately, only our tower companies and our heavy rescue have RIT packs on them. Our chief's cars, they have RIT packs on them as well. So our engine companies aren't as familiar with the equipment. And again, it's difficult, but yeah, everybody should have more training on it, because that just doesn't make you better at RIT operation. It makes you a better person overall, because if you really think about it, you would want your RIT guys or girls to be proficient at and knowledgeable in anything, everything on the fire service, fire behavior, building construction, engine company work, truck company work, hazmat. They should know a little bit of everything, but it's difficult to do. How do you do that? How do you find the time to train on that with all the other companies? I don't have that answer, but I know to get on those units, you have to have X amount of classes, X amount of training, and there's a standard that annual competency that you hold to be able to stick on that.
Bobby, you got, yeah, go ahead, Bobby.
So a question for you, Basil. So kind of following up on what John asked, what you're talking about is proactive firefighter safety, proactive firefighter survival. So you're not staging a reactive RIT team, you're staging a proactive firefighter survival team. So you're opening doors, you're providing lighting, you're throwing ladders. Just run through some of the stuff that you're doing in Orlando. And I know your organization well. I think it's one of the best organizations in America. It's an incredible fire department. And kudos to all the men and women there. Run through some of the training you're providing to the other companies, as well as the squads that handle the five-person squad in regards to those activities. Like, we all get ladders. What are some of the things that you've discovered that need to get done that might have gotten overlooked that you think have helped avoid Maydays? Because I would rather hear about Mayday avoidance than Mayday response.
Right. So really, it's a lot of it comes down to the company officers on those rigs. There is no mandated annual training when it comes to that. The training division does a good job at doing some of the basics, but it comes down to those company officers on there. And I can tell you, being assigned there, there was not a day that we didn't spend hours training on some aspect of the disciplines that the squads and the heavy entailed. So really is having a plan ahead of time. There was barely any communication, verbal communication, once we got to the scene. We knew as soon as we got to the scene, myself and then the center jump would start our 360 to the left. The left jump and then the driver would go to the right. We'd meet in the back. If there's anything that needed to get taken care of, we'd take care of it. If not, we would complete a full 360. Now we have multiple sets of eyes on the structure. The officer would meet with command. And then based on that, we would strategically place our cache of equipment where it needs to be. And then we start unlocking doors, throwing ladders, securing utilities, checking in on the inside with the guys, looking up the rosters to see which company is operating where and all of that. Some of the more specialized training, obviously all your technical rope rescue, building construction is huge, huge, huge. We are missing that in the fire service. The newer generation like myself, we're not teaching that well enough. We just know lightweight construction or one hour, all the type 1 through 5 or whatever it is nowadays. But really, that's a huge factor for the RIT companies. How are you gonna take the building apart to gain access or to create egress, your tool selection, how much resources are you gonna have? But our officer, when he was on there, and my same mindset now being assigned to the Tower 1 downtown, is we're gonna keep it as simple as possible. It's not because we're well-versed in all this technical rescue rope, this and that and the other, that we have to do all of it. Keep it simple. What's gonna save that person? Time. Now, if the victim needs air and they're entrapped and so on and so forth, we're going to handle that. But if you find the victim 15 feet into the structure with a relatively clear egress path, just drag the victim out. I keep it simple. We don't need to waste time packaging and doing all these crazy things when literally the solution and you have a safe space 15 feet, which is 30 seconds away from you. So we just pre-plan a lot of it, Chief. We try to be on the same page and we get the reps in. Repetition builds muscle memory builds instinct. And when you're in the hot seat, that's what you want. You want to be instinctive and have reflex to maximize time and effort. So that's that. We always try to new techniques, new packaging deal for, you know, if you're really entrapped or if you have to, you know, do some sort of high angle pickoff or below grade, whatever. We came up with a couple straps and all, but really we try to keep it simple. And by using live victims and each other, when we do these drills, you're actually seeing, for one, how bad you treat each other and the victims. So, and then if you have to do some sort of low pressure emergency swap, like a face piece replacement or a regulator replacement, a mannequin, you won't really feel it bleeding out or if you got a good seal, but one of us will tell you, hey man, like you don't even have a seal right now. You're just free flowing. So we just try to, you know, play as realistic as possible and get the job done as fast as possible. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, that was good, but it reminded me when we did the rapid interventionism, rapid training, we eventually started making guys wear helmets, not fire helmets, but like football helmets, because the guys, and we couldn't get guys and gals to volunteer to do that after a while, because you got the heck beat out of you. You really did. I mean, being a victim was brutal. It was just brutal.
Hey, Basil,
sir,
whether it's Orlando or in your class or on the third side of that, your opinion, does Orlando or do you teach in your class or do you think it's a good idea to actually deploy somebody into the building, a part of the RIT team? In the FDNY, our RIT training is mostly tactical training for removal of victims, you know, access removal, but there's a lot of leeway in there, a lot of flexibility for officers. There's a lot of truck captains. Every truck is a RIT truck in FDNY, right? So any truck can be called, and they all get called, you know, pretty regularly. There are some, and I'm stalling here, I haven't said it yet. A lot of captains will deploy the roof firefighter into the building to the roof, even though he's part of the RIT team. Now, we're arriving with 6 people. You're arriving with 5, and I know that's a couple more than probably the rest of the country has. But if you have a decent-sized RIT team, it works out very well to have somebody early deployed, pre-deployed to the roof position. He can do a survey 360 around the building. If we get involved in a life-saving rope evolution, he's up there with the life-saving rope already, even though some other truck guy's up there with his rope too. First do or second do roof person is up there anyway, but the RIT roof guy is up there already, pre-deployed before it happens. And it's worked out very well for Orlando that has a five-person RIT team. It would still leave you four people on the outside of the building doing that pre-deployment work. And you could have somebody inside, you know, to that roof position for multi-story buildings, obviously not a peaked roof house or something like that. But we've had great success with that. And I don't know if you do it in Orlando or if you teach it in your class.
Chief, that's a great point. I can't say that I've heard that before. We don't employ that tactics in our fire department. But, I mean, I'll bring it up to the guys and, you know, we'll maybe try it out.
Part of what you're describing when you're talking about they're active, they're proactive, and they're softening up the building, but there's a lot of intel and recon that's going on. And I think that's the Chief Salka's point too, is that you're not waiting for something to happen. When it happens, there's people in places, you've got information already. We're already thinking ahead. Same thing with throwing ladders, you know, identifying different points of egress, the building. Scott, you had something?
I want to shift gears a minute, and I agree with what everybody's saying. I think there's a lot of great classes about lifts and carry and remove, but I want to shift gears just a moment to the command function, I think, from Mayday Operation. And there's two things I kind of get hung up on. The first being, and I believe this very strongly, I think you're setting somebody up for failure if you expect the initial incident commander to take care of the smoke and fire problems that brought you there and then manage the Mayday. To me, the ones that I've been involved in, And so I think a system needs to build in as early as possible, somebody who can step in. When we had our Mayday on March 20th, it happened the first 8 minutes of the incident. Now, something we do that drives the National Fire Academy crazy whenever we send somebody there is we have our incident commander, but we assign an operations person next. That's the next person we assign. And the reason we do that in the event that the Mayday occurs, that operations chief automatically becomes a rescue chief. He knows where everybody is real time. He's most intimately familiar, and that person takes over and supervises the firefighter rescue. But I see so many time and time again, there's one guy at the car and he's calling alarms. He's directing fire attack and all these other things. And then he's got to worry about getting his firefighter out. And I think that's just positioning our people for failure. The second part of that is something I noticed, and I kind of call it Mayday denial. You'll hear these incident commanders that'll get hung up, and they'll either say things like, repeat your message, repeat your message, repeat your message, or everybody out of the building, everybody out of the building. It's kind of like they don't know how to engage. They don't want to accept that this is happening. And so I'd like to, you know, you guys got a lot of fire experience, talk a little bit about, before we run out of time, kind of the command component of dealing with a firefighter emergency.
Chief.
Well, I'm going to have to run, so I'll just jump in real quick. I love what you're doing there, Scott. And for some of the folks out there that might be listening, say, hey, we only send one chief or whatever. You can always pull a good captain in, have them run the Mayday. But that's smart business. So somebody stays focused on fighting the fire. But to John's point, you never move channels. So the one thing to be careful about here is, you know, the firefighter who's down is going to be on the channel that the firefight was on. You want to stay there. Who's ever running that Mayday stays there, because that person, the last thing in the world you want to, if you're actually trapped or lost or you've called a Mayday, is to have your radio suddenly go, you know, silent, like you're the only, you know, which would be terrifying.
And what you do is you demand radio discipline. Tell everybody to shut up unless it's directly related to saving the firefighter or the building coming down. Shut up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is great. And again, to Basil's point, that's where drill comes in, because when you have a real Mayday, it's just like LUNAR, right? The acronyms are great for training. You want to use it for training so people, you know,
whatever, I don't care, coal was wealth. The history of mankind, no incident commander walked up and said, construction, occupancy, area. It's just for, it's a learning tool. It's not a field tool. You could use it in an assessment center. You could use it in the classroom. You ain't using it at 3 o'clock in the morning when people's hair's on fire on the balcony. It ain't happening. So that being said, to your point, Scott, I like the idea of having a separate officer should command the Mayday, and a separate officer should continue the firefight, and radio discipline should be mandatory. There's no other way to say it. I just want to say a quick thank you to Basil for being on with us today. I think this is a great program. I was absolutely 100% serious. I'd love to see you write it up for us. We'd like to learn more about it for fire engineering. I hate to make the shameless plug for the show and such, but I think that would be critical. I know everybody listening out there on whatever that evil communist platform, Face Space or whatever, that are listening to us right now, which I think is the most disgusting place in the world to be. I can't wait for it to die a horrible death as a platform, not just a platform. But and if it gets us kicked off, good. Please think about that. Thank you so much. Thank you, Terry, for having me on. Scott, always great to see you. John, wonderful to see you. Remember to give me those phone numbers, John. I love everybody. God bless. Be safe. And we'll see you down the road.
I want to jump in and comment on Scott's comment and Basil's as well. And Terry, all of us really, I think, agree to some degree. But I think the command element, the command element of a lot of things needs a lot of work. But the command element in RIT operations, in Mayday situations, is horrendous. And I think if we have a stronger, better, more trained incident commanders, they'll be able to do that. You know, guys can recite all sorts of stuff about ventilation and all the things we do, right? Then they get a Mayday, and it's like they just arrived in a fire service 10 minutes ago. You know, and like you said, they're in denial, or they're repeating stuff, or they're not sure what to do with it. They're looking for some worksheet at the command post, and I'm saying to myself, if the guy at the top can't manage a Mayday situation, how do you expect anybody else to? The second thing is, well, you're in a big fire department like Orlando, like New York, like I mean, even Louisville and you guys, if you got more than one chief on duty, there should always be a second chief going on a working fire or anything that even looks like a working fire. And the minute you have a Mayday, Tommy, you got that good. I'm going to run the fire. You know, whether you have it written down, whether you have actual procedures to do that, or whether the two chiefs at the command post say, Tommy, you grab that. I'm going to run the fire. You do the Mayday. And at least we get somebody there. Everybody's got it. For those companies, you know, or departments that have maybe, you know, five stations and one battalion, isn't there five guys sitting at headquarters, a chief fire marshal and an operations guy and a training chief at the academy? And, you know, it should be set up so that another chief officer is dispatched to work in fires, whether they're a tactical guy in the field or whether the guy coming in from somewhere else. But that should be easily, FDNY, every working fire gets a second battalion chief and a deputy, the next rank up. And they're both there within a couple of minutes. And if we get a Mayday before they get there, obviously they have to struggle with it a little bit, but eventually somebody comes in and you have some help doing that. That's, you know, real big.
Yeah. I wanted to speak a little bit to Chief Thompson's point, what he mentioned earlier, that taking the formality out of the command part of it. That's something that I truly believe that RIT is personal. For many reasons. One, it's one of us that is in trouble. So there's a different connection than the people we serve. Not that we're more important than them by any means, but there is, whether you want to believe it or not, there is a connection there. So make everything from the radio talk to your actions informal. So if I'll give an example, if one of you gives the Mayday and you Mayday, or Chief Thompson, and you decide to use whatever acronym that you want to use, you send your Mayday. If I'm receiving the Mayday as the commanding officer on the outside, I'm not going to be on the radio and say, Command Orlando, Mayday received, strike a second alarm, all units on the fire ground, blah, 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 blah. It's not going to be all that professional jargon that I would normally speak of. I'm going to make it personal. I'm going to get on radio, Command Orlando, acknowledge Mayday, Hey, Chief Thompson, I'm going to call you Scott. So, hey, Scott, this is Chief Basil. Hey, buddy, slow your breathing down. Turn your flashlight on. Can you tell me how much air you have? I got Joe, Mike, and Bobby from the heavy rescue coming to get you right now. Okay? Turn your pass alarm off. We're coming to get you, buddy. Just like that. So just by talking to somebody like a human, not like a robot, you're de-stressing this situation from the outside. Whether you know it or not, you're building, you're releasing all those chemicals in the brain, and it's slowing their heart rate down. It's slowing the respiratory rate down, conserving their air consumption. And you're
going to say, there's science, not to, there's science to back that up. And you know, if you read Dave Grossman's stuff on survival stress reaction, right, that there's science. And I think that the things that we can do across the board to put a firefighter on scene with less anxiety, the greater his or her chances of solving their own problems, because we know our fine motor skills begin to decrease, where our gross motor skills. So there's science. That's right on the money. That's a great point. Thank you for.
You'll prevent them to add to your point. You'll prevent them from going from that condition red to condition black from Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman's book there. You know, there'll be less tunnel vision. They'll be able to hear more. They won't have the auditory exclusion, you know, just from the outside. And then again, I love that Chief Sacco says, don't change the attack channels. I cannot stand when people do that. And you know what? This is the standard. I hate to say it, but that's the standard across a lot of departments in the country. I'm doing this project right now. Chief Thompson, I sent you a little questionnaire. You're actually one of the few that responded. It's sad, but it's true. And that's like that nationally. We got to be able to change that and be able to quantify it.
We can't get our guys to change the channel sitting in the front seat of the fire truck to go from channel one to channel two. Never mind when they're in a position where it's a little hot and hairy.
It must be the radio guys. It must be the radio manufacturers or somebody, because – you know, and I've been saying this for years, and I know the FDNY is not the end all to everything. I fully understand that. We're a big fire department, but we have some stuff that we've been doing for a long time. My whole career, and I'm already retired 10 years, and we have one radio channel. Our handy talkies are deliberately built weak. They're only about 3 or 4 watts. Everybody in all 2,000 guys on duty in New York City right now are on the same channel. They're all on channel one. 200 of them are in supermarkets talking about buying ham and cheese. 200 of them are on BI talking about come up to the third floor and bring the VO book. And 200 of them are at fires, but they don't interfere with each other, because the guy that designed that 50 or 60 years ago said, let's use weak radios that just work from point to point, and they'll work for 2 or 3 blocks around each other, and then they fade away. I worked the 6 fires one night in Rescue 3, and I never changed channels, because every fire we got to, I was on the right channel. As I drove away, they lost me and I lost them. And when I got close to the next one, I was on the right channel there. It's just so simple. And I have these two station departments with 3 engines in one truck that have repeaters and all sorts of other fancy equipment mounted on their apparatus when they can buy practically stock stuff off the shelf and communicate better with each other. So I think sometimes this techno nerd attitude of some people, whoever that is, I'm not pointing fingers, but it really gets out of hand. I think sometimes people look at technology as the solution. And sometimes I think it's the problem. Sometimes people get a little bit too technical instead of trying to keep things a little bit more, I might use the caveman terminology because it fits me perfectly, but you know, I think the more simple things are, there certainly is a place and a time for technology, you know, but like, for example, May Days, you give a May Day in the FDNY, the chief doesn't have to do anything. All he has to do is get on the radio and give a signal, 1066, and he's done. And I know Louisville adopted that. Rick adopted that, I think. So he doesn't have to say, give me 2 more engines and another truck and the second alarm and 3 more chiefs. It's built into the system, so he doesn't have to tangle with it. He can just give a signal and turn his attention back to what he's doing. So I think you're so right, Basil, to simplify and humanize some of these things rather than elevate them into, you know, things to remember and you know.
Well, and you said, Basil, you said earlier about working on the techniques, like you would get so analyze a situation and come up with some, you know, you've got a truck full of all these new paratechs. And so it's like you're looking for a reason to use all this stuff. And I like what you said earlier. Hey, the simplest solution lock into that, solve the problem. That's what we want to do, ultimately solve the problem. And you know, the Chief Salka's point is that, you know, and I've accused myself of that because I spend a majority of my day sitting in my office and I'm trying to solve problems. I come up with all these great ideas. And then all of a sudden, one day you go out there and you watch something and you go, what the hell are you guys doing? Well, this is what you told us to do. And I'm like, man, that don't work. You know, that didn't work. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, it we're up against the end of the show here. And I mean, we could literally go on for you know, another hour for sure talking about this. And it's certainly a topic worthy of it all. But I want to go around the horn here and just I want to tell everyone that's listening. So the panel that you see before you, me excluded, they're all at FDIC. So, just kind of a last thought or a final thought or something. And then also, you know, if somebody wants to reach out and contact you, if they have any questions, especially you, Basil, that if they want to reach out to you, maybe get your program, talk to you about your program or just get some help from you. So, Scott, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I don't think you can put enough emphasis on this. And like Basil said, it involves everything we do, stretching, throwing, forcing. You know, we had one recently. We learned a lot of things. To me, as an incident commander, it's when you're going to be tried the most. It's personal. You know the guys involved. Maybe you worked with them. And I don't know if you ever can be prepared enough, but you can surely be unprepared. You know, I always used to ask myself when I was sitting at the car, just a little tickle, just, you know, right now, what if the Mayday went down right now? Would I be ready? And that way it's not a surprise. But I think the classes that you're doing, Basil, and some of the other ones, the technique, the carries, the drags, but also the command component are so important, because if you don't have strong leadership kind of rowing the boat, it can become a chaotic mess in a hurry. And you just think about it. If a firefighter goes down with a heart attack, nothing, no fancy fire situation. You got 6 minutes, 6 minutes to find them, drag them out, get their gear off, start doing CPR. And that's non-negotiable. That's a set time. So being proficient is a pretty big deal, but thank you for coming on, Scott at fireserviceleadership.com. If you got any questions, I'll be glad to share whatever I have.
Thanks for that. Chief Salka?
Yeah, you know, I have to echo what Scott said. And obviously what Basil's doing is the solution to the problem. You know, and we all try and do it. We're all out there teaching. We've been doing it for years, hands-on and otherwise. And if nobody's training RIT and Mayday operations enough, nobody. And if you really do some good training, Rick and I have talked about this. If you really go out there and do a good Mayday, a legitimate Mayday, where you got to go find a guy and get back to him and send a team in, And if switching channels is what you do and you switch it at your drill, you don't have to listen to me. You'll discover yourself that switching channels doesn't work. So some good, realistic RIT and Mayday training is the only thing that's going to make RIT or Mayday operations work well. You can't do your first one at a real fire. It's just not going to work. You got to get some time in. And the command and that command function as well. They have to be able to, you know, get used to interacting with the RIT team, interacting with the other folks inside the building, you know? Yeah. If you want to contact me, chiefjohnsalka@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you. And Basil, kick it to you. Any final thoughts? And then certainly your contact information you're willing to share and help some of our guests out if they want to reach out to you.
Okay. Well, I'm going to echo both the chiefs here. The key to good decision making on the fire ground and good action is preparation. Training. Okay, you can't predict the future, you can't predict what's going to happen, but you can try to replicate it and create it in training. So keep the reps, try new things, and hopefully it works out. Put it all to the clock and go to conferences, attend conferences. Now, if you're an instructor and teacher, go as a student. Every once in a while, it's good. It humbles you. It refreshes you. I was honored to be part of this webcast with you guys. I look up to all of you for a long time. You're all my digital mentors. If you want to contact me, you can find me on all social media platforms. Proactive Rescue Operation is the name of our company, or the email is profbtraining@gmail.com.
Perfect. Thank you for that. So we always, our next show, by the way, is March 16th. We have our Humpty Hangout is the third Wednesday of every month. So March 16th should be our next show. We always end the show by reminding you to think of our men and women serving in our military. We've got some pretty precarious things going on right now throughout the world. And certainly they're always in our thoughts and our prayers. And you know, we never end a show without reminding people that never forgetting means never forgetting. So with that, thanks for tuning in. We look forward to talking again in another great topic next month. Thanks a lot.
Take care, boys.
Take care.